Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
On Commons People this week, the end of lockdown is in sight.
Today there really is, the end really is in sight.
But Downing Street's in turmoil.
It may be a reflection of the fact that perhaps some people don't know what their purpose is now that Brexit is over.
And Labour and the Tories reverse roles on taxes.
That now is not the time for tax rises for families and for businesses.
Yeah. Prime Minister.
Hello and welcome to Commons People. I'm Arj Singh and joining me this week is Paul Waugh.
Hi Arj.
Hi Paul. Rachel Wearmouth's here.
Hi Arj.
Hi Rachel. And we've got the former special advisor to the Chancellor, Sonia Khan.
Hi Arj.
Hi Sonia. Well, things are looking up after Boris Johnson published his roadmap for lifting lockdown this week. The weather's improving and people are looking forward to children returning to school, family get-togethers at Easter, pints in April and big events this summer. Intriguingly, the PM also U-turned on his opposition to vaccine passports, ordering a review to report this spring on whether people could be asked to show proof they've been jabbed to enter certain venues. Let's hear Johnson unveiling the roadmap on Monday.
There will be others who will believe that we could go faster on the basis of that vaccination programme. And I understand their feelings. And I sympathise very much with the exhaustion and the stress that people are experiencing and the businesses are experiencing after so long in lockdown. But to them, and to them all, I say that today the end really is in sight, Mr. Speaker. And a wretched year will give way to a spring and a summer that will be very different and incomparably better than the picture we see around us today. And in that spirit, Mr. Speaker, I commend this statement to the House.
Paul, in that clip, the PM referred to Tory backbenchers who want him to go faster in lifting lockdown. Is there any chance of that happening if the data kind of progresses a bit better than planned, I suppose?
Well, the simple and short answer is no, because we've asked this to Number 10 a few times, and they've been pretty categoric in following up what the PM said, which is that these 5-week pauses between each of the stages, they're sort of non-negotiable. And even if the data looks like it's going really well, they're not going to accelerate anything. Now, that's really interesting because it shows that they're finally listening to the SAGE scientists. I mean, it was very clear the SAGE documents that were released on Monday alongside the PM statement that they said, look, you really need a pause to assess all the data, see whether things are working, and only then can you consider even lifting anything, never mind doing things quicker. So I'm afraid that at the earliest, at the end of this process, June 21st is still the earliest date for everything. It could definitely slip by a week or two or more for each stage. And if you add on to each stage, then you could see that date going further back. But it's worth saying that the reason they've come up with those dates is they're pretty confident they can meet them. Because I think Number 10 know, when as soon as you mention a date, everyone starts planning their lives around them. So for them to have to delay any of this would be so politically difficult that I think they've been ultra cautious, and that's why I think they'll stick to it. There is the other problem for a lot of Tory MPs on the back benches, which is, you know, if Scotland is going down the tiering route, which Nicola Sturgeon is, with different areas are allowed to go at different paces, I think that could be a problem for the Prime Minister. I mean, already this morning, someone tweeted me that in their area on the border of Devon and Cornwall, there are zero cases and there've been zero cases in the past week. That's cases, not even deaths. And you can imagine the clamour growing for certainly some MPs saying, well, hold on a sec, why shouldn't we open our pubs if there's no risk right now here? And I think Number 10's answer is, well, the variant is so, it spreads so fast, the rules have all changed, you can't do that. But I'm not sure that argument's going to wash.
Yeah, I've spoken to several rural Conservative MPs who want to see the kind of regional tier system return, precisely because of that reason. They've been behind in cases compared to other regions for the whole pandemic. Sonia, anyway, the PM said on Monday that part of the reason for going slow was to protect people who don't take up the vaccine. But the COVID recovery group of lockdown skeptic Tory backbenchers said society shouldn't be held back by those who choose not to have a jab. There's obviously a particular focus on BAME communities here, black and minority ethnic. So does this debate risk turning nasty?
I think that the debate will have quite serious repercussions, if anything, more so than being nasty. And there's a reflection of the fact that actually politicians are still out of touch with many, many communities on both sides. And I grew up in an Asian community, and often the figures of authority are like religious, cultural, usually male. And people take their word as gospel. And I think the government hasn't really been able to sort of penetrate those groups. And there are local champions, and it's a bit sporadic. But I think there's just no uniformity in policy in dealing with people from BAME backgrounds. And you see that in the fact that, do you remember a few weeks ago, there was the special advisor on ethnicity kind of got into a bit of a row with Kemi Badenoch. I think that's just, you know, one reflection of the fact that nobody knows how to move forward. And you kind of can't brush it under the carpet, because a lot of people, mostly because they're told by their family that they should be doctors and they can't really be anything else, but a lot of them work in healthcare. So they work in hospitals, they work in frontline roles. I was reading somewhere that actually in some hospitals, like less than a third of groups are willing to get the vaccine. So that stumbling block is always going to be there. You kind of can't work around them, otherwise you have this massive gap in workforce.
Yeah, that's interesting. And the government's obviously launched a kind of, or tried to launch kind of BAME-specific communications. What have you made of their efforts so far?
I think the communications are nice and fine. And the government's approach is always to go like quite macro almost. But we sort of saw it in the Remain Leave campaign that you can get as many celebrities on board, but it doesn't principally kind of change how people feel, especially in sort of low income backgrounds. And you really need to get into kind of who are people listening to, who are they taking their advice from? And it is these local figures. It can be a local councillor. It can be someone who's head of kind of whatever faith you're practicing and whatever else. And I think having national faith leaders is great, but we haven't really seen a cohesive sort of local strategy.
Yeah. And Sadiq Khan said this week or last week that the government's kind of culture war approach isn't helping in this area. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think that's definitely right. There's really sort of conflicted messaging. Like, there's a sense that people are too woke now, or it's much kind of too PC, and then there is a bit of a coordinated campaign to kind of almost do the opposite.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. And Rachel, the government's reviewing vaccine passports now. Do you think we'll see them being introduced? And that could obviously have implications for people who don't get vaccinated and in certain communities.
Well, there's two different kinds of vaccine passports. So there's sort of the international ones where you would sort of be able to go on holiday, and that's kind of a separate thing to sort of domestic vaccine passports, where you know you'd have proof that you'd had a vaccine in order to get into, say, like a pub or entertainment venue or something like that. And that the sort of the domestic vaccine passports that are much more complicated, it seems, because this would go to you know, whether a business could discriminate against an individual because of, say, their disability, or they're pregnant, or because of their religious belief. And I think that's kind of much more complicated than, you know, what we might, I know we're in negotiations with sort of Greece at the moment, for example, in order to have an international vaccine passport. But I think when it comes down to how individual businesses might behave, or how an individual venue might behave, I think it gets a lot more complicated in terms of the legal picture. Yeah.
Paul, do you think we're going to see vaccine passports introduced, domestic vaccine passports? And it's probably going to run into quite a lot of opposition from Tory backbenchers. I don't quite know where Labour stand on that because I might be a bit ignorant, but
yeah, it's a good question, actually, because Labour have so far not given a position on domestic passports. Obviously they'll share everyone's concerns about discrimination, but at the same time I think they know that they can't be seen to be against unlocking bits of the economy that might actually be unlocked by these passports. It's interesting that when we asked Number 10 about this week, it was clear that there were they were sort of still in the embryonic stages of working this out. And it's also clear that they said, look, you know, current premises have every right for discretion on who they bar from their premises, you know, as long as they're within the law on discrimination, then, you know, and this would just be another form of discretion. And you can imagine, you know, you've got no right to be allowed into, you know, Soho House or a nightclub if your face doesn't fit, you know, for whatever reason and you're in the line.
Soho House, Paul, very, very fancy. Is that where you hang out? Is that where you're going when lockdown ends?
I only ever been invited. I'm not a member. But you can imagine if you're outside Fabric, for example, and you're in the queue, and they just, you know, they might say, well, not you, not you, or whatever. They've got, and pubs as well, they have a discretion to bar people if they're white. So you can imagine, but actually I think where this will really matter, and Tony Blair's talked about this, is that it might come from the public rather than from the government. The public might say, I want a totally free cheek by jowl experience when I go to a nightclub or when I go to a pub or a theatre. I don't want to wear a mask. What's the point of doing that in a nightclub? If this little digital thing on my phone says that actually I've had a negative test in the last few days, and which is separate from vaccination, so you're not forcing people to be vaccinated. If you can prove you've had a negative test, you've got a negative status, you can enjoy things like, you know, going on the terraces in a football match or something like that, or going to a nightclub. You can imagine, or even the theatre, that would work. And then you have an authentic live experience, which a lot of people are desperate for, let's be honest. I mean, there's not much point going back and doing these things wearing a mask. So I think that actually the public might drive some of it, and that could be really interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting as well. You just wonder if, as more people get vaccinated, how much pressure that timeline for opening up comes under.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, especially you've got Professor John Bell from Oxford, who's a big believer in lateral flow tests. He said to a select committee this week that actually there was no reason. He said there'll be pressure, you know, if once people are vaccinated, everyone's vaccinated, there'll be massive pressure to unlock things.
Yeah. Go on, Rachel.
Labour's position seems to be that they support the international vaccine passports, but that they have a lot of unanswered questions about the domestic vaccine passports. They think leaving it to businesses might be a bad idea, and they are very worried about sort of no jab, no job, you know, like in the style of Pimlico Plumbers, who've kind of said that they plan to ask for them.
Yeah.
So I think the employment side of it as well. And there's also the privacy issue that, you know, if you kind of, you know, I know a lot of privacy campaigners have a lot of concern about it as well, whether it might end up being sort of, I think they've described it as like a backdoor to ID cards, basically. Backdoor.
Yeah, they are worried about that. And I think that that's why I think separating the test from the jab is really important, because you make a public health case, you know, for not wearing a mask at an event. And that's an option. In other words, as long as you don't bar people from public services or ordinary everyday services, if this is an add-on to something special like a football match or a nightclub or something like that, then I can imagine the government will say that's up to individual businesses. And I can imagine Labour might even go for that, because at the end of the day, it's about protecting jobs of those people who are running those nightclubs and those pubs and events and running the turnstile in a football club. You know what I mean?
It's interesting that, because they can't just leave it up to businesses, because presumably the government would have to facilitate it.
They'd have to give them some sort of legal, you know, indemnity if they do it. Yeah. And make sure it's not discriminatory.
But also provide the proof, I suppose.
Yeah, that'd have to be a really common system. And that's why one of the most interesting things was number 10 talking about this idea of the NHS app, not the COVID app, but the appointments app, which is much less popular. And it's, I think there's only about 5 million downloads compared to 20 million downloads of the COVID one, which is, you know, used to book appointments in your GPs and other and keeps your records on it. Now, that's obviously, that covers a lot of the privacy concerns. It's up to you what you put on there. And I think I can see why they're going down that route. Apparently, they're really impressed by a similar system in Israel. And not for the first time, Israel seems to be ahead on the tech.
Sonia, Michael Gove's leading this review into vaccine passports. Where do you think he is on it, sort of naturally?
I mean, well, he's being quite public about the fact that he doesn't like them. He didn't want them to happen. I remember there was a long period over the last kind of few months, because, I mean, I work in consultancy now with business, and they've all followed this so closely, because a lot of them are, you know, global, they're multinational, they want to go see their people. They think a lot of business is best done sort of face to face. So the international element bothers them. But they've been confused, because number 10 spokesperson says it's happening. Michael Gove says it's not happening. Then there's a story saying there's actually a pilot case in the Cabinet Office that's been led by a company called iProve. And then you read the another newspaper. So it's been a bit sort of confusing. But yeah, he does seem to be a bit of a sort of natural skeptic on this. But I think he's accepted that the US now, which is actually far further behind the UK on vaccinations, is also thinking about vaccination passports. So we might just be pushed into it. And if you have no choice anyway, then you want to, we may as well be the global leader in setting whatever the standard is. So I suspect that bit's quite attractive to him, appealing to his kind of natural competitive instinct, wanting the UK to be kind of the first ahead in the development of this, and something his kind of department will really, really own. Quite a good sort of thing to have to hold against Matt Hancock when you're talking about reshuffle. Like, you may have some vaccines, but I've got the vaccine passports rolling out and the economy open again.
Yeah, it's a good point, actually, because I think Sonia's right. You know, Gove is very competitive in lots of ways. He likes to be seen as a doer in Whitehall. You know, when he was at education, at least he was one of the few secretaries of state to actually do things, to achieve things, for good or ill. At least he did things. And I think what's fascinating is that number 10, Boris Johnson, decided, well, here's a big complex problem. I'll give it to you, Michael. Here's a hot potato. And it might be that you know, having stripped him of various other things on Brexit, maybe he just thinks, well, it's not as if he hasn't got a lot to do. But, you know, if Gove can make it work, then, you know, maybe his reputation will work ahead of a reshuffle. And maybe there is that move towards the Home Office that people have talked about. Well, having said that, the Home Office, as everyone knows, is a graveyard for every politician.
I tipped Gove for the Home Office back in autumn when I wrote that piece about him. I just like to claim. Well, speaking of Gove and him being stripped of his Brexit responsibilities, Downing Street appeared to descend into chaos last week with resignations and infighting. First, Carrie Simmons' allies, Henry Newman and Baroness Finn, were appointed as advisers to the Prime Minister. And it started a chain reaction which saw Johnson's key Brexit adviser, Lord Frost, promoted to the Cabinet and taking over a lot of Gove's responsibilities, and the resignation of Oliver Lewis, head of the Number 10 Union Unit, after just a few days in charge. But former Tory leader thinks things have improved since the departure of Dominic Cummings. Let's have a listen.
Yeah, I think there has been a big improvement, actually, and I pointed this out recently. I don't want to personally attack the people who left. They were brilliant people, but maybe running government wasn't their greatest skill compared to running campaigns. Well, now some people have been brought in who are very good at running government. You know, the Prime Minister has a new chief of staff. He's made other recent appointments. And you can tell over the last couple of months that government has worked better. There's been more under-promising and over-delivering rather than the other way around. There have been fewer rows, there have been fewer destructive leaks and side briefings to the press. You can just tell, you can smell it, that things have improved in the way things work in government. The public can smell it as well.
Paul, can you explain what's going on in Number 10 and why the Bow Group Tory think tank is calling for an inquiry into Carrie Simmons' influence in Number 10?
Well, it's worth stepping back a bit. You know, why are we getting this sort of rash of stories about all the minions in Number 10? Ultimately, the real reason is that, you know, we're in the court of a king, King Boris. And when you've got a court, then the courtiers are the people who are talked about. And the reason you've got a court is because there is no one, and Sonia will know this better than anyone else, there's no one, a rival power base, the Prime Minister in Cabinet. You know, he's dominant. He completely dominates that Cabinet, unlike any Prime Minister since Thatcher, I personally think. You know, Blair had Brown as a counterbalance. Cameron obviously had Osborne. Theresa May had everybody else, you know. But you've got Boris here. And Rishi Sunak, who, let's be honest, you know, you can sum up his relationship with Boris Johnson with that press conference where he went, thanks, PM. It was like a head boy to a headmaster, wasn't it? And it's not as if he's got the clout to stand up to the Prime Minister. And so when that happens, when you've got that massive dominance by just one person, then it is a court. And within that court, you've got people like Henry Newman, Baroness Finn, who are both very talented, by the way. I mean, it's worth saying that Henry Newman when he worked for Francis Maud, achieved a lot of things in government. And we were just talking about Michael Gove, but Maud actually did quite a lot of things within the machinery of the civil service, whether it's more transparency. And Henry was instrumental in that. And he's a really important figure. He's also a good friend of Carrie Simmons. And there's certainly true, there's a lot of sexism about the idea that somehow Carrie Simmons is this Lady Macbeth figure. The Bow Group, this Tory think tank who've suggested that her role should be now opened up to scrutiny. Well, there's a couple of things there. One is that the Bow Group isn't the old Bow Group. Honestly, I'm so old, I remember when the Bow Group was this really respected organisation and people would go to it. And it was a slightly soft left Tory, centre-left Tory group. And since then, it's become quite idiosyncratic. And whoever runs it, it's become much smaller than it was. Whoever runs it gets its great platform because they can say whatever they like because it's the Bow Group. But actually, I think I'm not sure they're really in step with many Tory members in suggesting that somehow Carrie Simmons' role in all this is really damaging and that there should be an inquiry into what she says and how she runs government. Because at the end of the day, as Number 10 have insisted, you know, Carrie Simmons actually first was on maternity leave, but now is working for the Aspinall Foundation, the zoos organisation. So it's not as if she's working. She hasn't got a job in Number 10. Yes, she's got influence. Of course she has, because she's an experienced former Tory comms director. But that influence is ultimately overblown, I think. At the end of the day, we shouldn't forget the Prime Minister, all the buck stops with him. And I think actually it's a cop-out and it's too easy for him to say, is Carrie running the show? You know, yeah, of course he likes other people to have an opinion, but ultimately anything is down to him when it comes to Brexit or the union unit.
Yeah, Sonia, what have you made of the wranglings in Number 10? You've obviously experienced the absolute worst of Boris Johnson's Downing Street, but that was when Dominic Cummings was there and so on. But what have you made of the last week or so of stories?
I feel like, personally, it may be a reflection of the fact that perhaps some people don't know what their purpose is now that Brexit is over, given that was, you know, a prominent, if not the only feature of the general election campaign. And the biggest challenge, I think, for Boris has always been, and I remember when I started as a spy in that government, which was like a long time ago now, was that there were very, very distinct factions that almost have their own objectives, that have their own way of working, their own relationships. When we did the first ever special advisor meeting, it was sort of like almost like going to secondary school for the first time. So there was like a row of the old spuds, a row of the kind of city hall team, and then kind of the vote lead team. And you sort of like didn't interact. You didn't want to step out of your line into the other line because you might be branded, you're one of the other people. And I don't think there was ever an effort to kind of get over that or bring everyone together and say, right, this is kind of the PM's vision, this is what he's going to do, like this is how you fit into it. And people have sort of found their own role. Some of them have done that through the media and not, and you kind of see that basically when one faction goes, it can be quite contentious if you're sort of isolated or sort of left out, because you don't really know what you're doing, because you pledge your allegiance to almost like whoever leads your grouping rather than the PM. I don't know if I've articulated that well enough or if that sort of makes sense.
Yeah, it sort of sounds to me like Boris Johnson hasn't really got control of these people under him, to me.
Well, I think that's why, I think the idea of a chief of staff and deputy chiefs of staff, so you can't let you create real kind of accountability in that process, especially if you like centralise a special advisor kind of system, is needed. And maybe we'll see that with sort of more political special advisors, so people who are a bit more aligned to kind of the political party coming in.
Yeah, because he's appointed Dan Rosenfeld, who's completely non-political, as chief of staff. Do you think that's a mistake then?
Well, he's meant to be balanced out by kind of Baroness Finn, and not many sort of civil servants, especially at the Treasury, go on to be special advisors. But I felt like his appointment was more about bridging the gap between Number 10 and Number 11, which, you know, I've been in the middle of it. There's always great friction. But then that kind of leaves someone else to do the management of the SPADs and the HR. And I actually thought it was quite a good idea that they had Katie Lamb, who properly inducted people, because when you start, nobody ever tells you how to do your job. You don't. Sometimes you don't even get a job description. You sort of know there's a media spad and a policy spad. So now that kind of she's gone and that system's gone, it does leave kind of a bit of a gap to allow this sort of sniping to go on. So it is a hole that they want to sort of fill really, really quickly.
Yeah, and obviously there's a policy issue at the heart of all this, Rachel, which is that there is currently, or there doesn't appear to be, or didn't until maybe today, a Number 10 union unit. And that's one of the biggest concerns kind of facing the government.
Yeah, because they've got the Holyrood elections coming up in May, and everything that's happening with Nicola Sturgeon and Alex Salmond, they'll want to sort of be on top of this as much as possible. So, but it seems that there's not only one union unit, but there's two that we found out in Lobby about today. So there's sort of like a implementation policy unit, which will be chaired by Michael Gove and will focus on the government side of it. And then there'll be a strategy number 10 unit led by the Prime Minister, and we'll also take in Michael Gove's leadership, and also take in Lord Frost, and that'll be more of a cabinet-led unit. So yeah, they're kind of trying to focus on it, but just kind of, I wonder if a lot of like all of these stories we're seeing about divisions and changing personnel and things like this, it seems to be like a change in Boris Johnson, because when he was Mayor of London, he was known for like delegating all of his work, and I've read just numerous times over the last few months that like Boris Johnson has got to take personal charge of this, and he's got to take personal charge of that. And I just wonder if he's not delegating. There doesn't seem to be like Paul was talking about earlier. There doesn't seem to be another power base beyond Boris Johnson at the moment, and that is causing a lot of infighting. And we've seen a lot of that within the union strategy as well.
I think the thing about Boris Johnson is that he's almost like a sort of hands-off 1950s Darwinian father. It sort of wants all the children to sort of fight it out and let them get on with it, and they can have the scuffles, and they'll only come in if someone actually comes in crying with a sort of broken arm, but otherwise he'll just let them on, get on with it. And I think that's the way he approaches everyone around him. He likes a sense of chaos. I hate to say it, it's sort of he quite likes that. And ultimately, I think there'll be his undoing in lots of different areas, because you can't have a chaotic part of government. You just can't. And that Dan Rosenfield is a really interesting appointment, as Sonia was saying. That is his massive Treasury experience means that he can, you know, be a bridge with Number 10. But more than the bridge, I think that means the PM, he can let the PM drive what he wants through the Treasury, because he knows all the Treasury tricks. He knows the scams they pull. He knows how they try and pull the wool over a PM's eyes. Don't forget Rosenfield, he worked under New Labour. He didn't just work under the last Tory administration. So he's very smart, but also I think he's coming up against the politics, the sheer politics of this now. I think he looks like a real innocent abroad in the Tory wars that take part between the vote leavers and the non-vote leavers. So that's difficult. And also, don't forget, the thing we haven't mentioned is that the real absence of grip ultimately partly comes down to the fact that we've got a new cabinet secretary. Simon Case is really well rated, just like Rosenfield, really smart guy, but he hasn't got the clout to say to the Prime Minister, like Jeremy Hayward would, "I'm sorry, Prime Minister, you've got to do this." And he doesn't have the same clout when he's telling a department, "Look, this is what you have to do." Everyone used to say within Whitehall, when you got an email from Jeremy Hayward, it was the word of God, you had to do it. And I don't think that's quite there yet.
He's also got just so many competing priorities from his MPs. He's got the Northern Research Group, he's got the COVID Recovery Group, and he can't really afford to isolate any one group. So he's got a lot of competing priorities on his backbenchers, from his backbenchers as well.
Yeah, that's very true. Sonia, I mean, bottom line of this, is this essentially the vote leave guard, the last of the vote leave guard being sort of moved out of Number 10 and the Carrie Simmons crew taking control with the civil service?
It sort of feels like it, but I wouldn't write them off just yet, because their skills are in campaigning, and at some point a campaign is going to come back, and that's the next general election campaign. So I think the Prime Minister's almost trying to balance that, keeping both sides happy, because you could actually be quite robust and say, like, I'm not going to have kind of any more briefing. Here are the boundaries that I'm setting. Here's what access people are going to have. You can institute that discipline from the start, but I think he knows that he needs them back. And that's why, but kind of in this form of stasis, where it feels like we can't really move forward, because there are two still quite influential groups who have a play, at least in the PM's mind, and actually probably for a lot of people in government, given that they've got quite strong relations to that team, not least with sort of Michael Gove, Priti Patel. But I don't think you can lose the vote leave influence.
Yeah, and I suppose ever. Lord Frost's promotion to the cabinet is evidence of that, him still trying to keep that kind of side happy. But my favourite story out of this series of stories of the last week has been, well, who you'd expect to be an innocent abroad in all this was Dylan the dog. He's apparently a central figure. I don't know if any of you have met this dog, but he's said to have a sinister edge and apparently angered Dominic Cummings by humping his leg.
It's such a great image, isn't it?
What a story.
What I was fascinated by was the idea that Dylan with Checkers had torn everything apart, all the furniture. You think, crikey, who's paying for that?
Yeah, indeed.
One point I did want to make on kind of, do we think these factions could come back is, don't forget, Lord Frost needs, he's a cabinet minister now, he's going to get special advisors, and he's got a lot of leverage at the moment, so it'll be interesting to see who he picks. But also, special advisors become a negotiation in a reshuffle. And so if people are moved to places and they don't want to go, they could use that as a way to bring back people that have left.
That's really interesting.
Be interesting to see in the summer.
That's a very good point. Really
That's
interesting.
That's a very good point. Would you go back, Sonia, now that the Eye of Sauron has disappeared?
I think it's too easy. I really enjoy kind of my current job, and I did 5 government departments. So there's not, I was thinking about this, there's not really one I could go back into and feel like I'm moving forward.
Yeah. Well, from number 10, of course.
That's true. But I have to say, I'm quite geeky and I do quite like a lot of the sort of like treasury budget stuff. But I also remember like the fact that I never got any sleep, weddings, pretty much every social event was interrupted. And I kind of like having my weekends back for.
That is a good idea. Mind you, if Sajid went back and there's a talk about him going back, would you be tempted?
Oh, I think it would depend on kind of what role he got and what role he might see me playing. But actually, I'm quite liking being on the other side, which is dealing with the impact of kind of government policy sort of decision making and seeing how our business works, how they engage government. It's a side I haven't done. I did the public sector straight out of university. So yeah. Not immediately.
Talking of the Treasury, it's a big week for Rishi Sunak as he prepares to deliver the budget next week. A few months ago, Tories were hoping this could be the time the Chancellor could break out of the straitjacket of COVID and begin setting out his plan for the economic recovery. But with restrictions continuing until June, Sunak is likely to again focus on support measures, including extending the furlough scheme to summer. The big question vexing Tory backbenchers, though, is whether the Chancellor plans to hike taxes to fill a gigantic black hole in the public finances, while Labour is opposing any tax increases. Let's just hear Keir Starmer and Boris Johnson clashing on this at PMQs.
But couldn't the Prime Minister at least agree with me today that now is not the time for tax rises for families and for businesses?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I don't know about you, but the budget is happening next week. It's not a date that is concealed from the Right Honourable Gentleman. He knows when it's happening, he knows what to expect. But it's preposterous for him, Mr. Speaker, to talk about tax rises. I mean, he stood on a manifesto only a year ago, Mr. Speaker, or a little over a year ago, to put up taxes by the biggest amount in the history of this country.
Paul, we're in a bit of a weird situation going into this budget, aren't we? We've got Tory rebels potentially siding with Labour to vote against tax rises.
Well, yeah, and we're in yet another surreal situation, aren't we? I mean, Starmer is so determined that the message he wants to get out, and particularly ahead of these local elections, is Labour's changed. And how's Labour changed? Well, it's not in favour of just whacking taxes on everything as being the answer to everything. Now, the big problem with that is their own 2019 manifesto had not just a range of tax rises, but unprecedented tax rises. And the central one, the easy one, was corporation tax going up. And it does raise a massive amount of money, as Sonia will tell you. You know, it's just a few percentage points is billions that it raises. So in many ways, it's a low-hanging fruit for any Labour government is to just whack up corporation tax. Now, Rishi Sunak has seen same low-hanging fruit and thought, right, I'll take a bit of that, thank you. It's an easy hit. Business obviously will be furious in some ways, but actually maybe a bit relaxed, saying, okay, we've got to pay a bit more. You know, maybe it'll come back down again at some point. Certainly George Osborne will be furious because he set this, you know, long-term trajectory to make sure that Britain, within or without the EU, had one of the world's lowest corporation taxes. And so that Osborne agenda has been torn up. But I think the difficult for Labour is, because it was a central piece of their manifesto, are they really going to whip their MPs next week in the budget to vote against something that they just stood on a manifesto on to increase? Well, they might do. I'll tell you why. Because, again, it's all about changing their image in those small towns, not just the red wall seats, but small towns up and down England and Wales and Scotland, but particularly England, that think that Labour is a high tax party. And if Labour can say at every local elections, look, we wouldn't put up your council tax as much, we certainly wouldn't whack taxes on anything, now is the wrong time. We've got all these great think tanks like the IFS, the OECD, everyone internationally saying putting up taxes now is the wrong time, it would choke off recovery. We're the pro enterprise, pro business, pro growth party. You can see why Starmer's doing that. I can get it. I think the problem is, as he'll find out, and as we might report this afternoon, quite a few Labour MPs are not going to be very pleased with that. You know, and you can see, if you're a Labour MP, would you really say that you should lose the whip for voting on something in your own manifesto, something this simple? And I think actually, although tactically it's quite good for Starmer in the short term, in the long term, the voters may just not believe him either, because at the next election, you're going to see something like a wealth tax. You're going to see some serious taxes put on business from Labour. And what are they going to say? Well, we didn't believe it really back in 2021, but we believe it now. I think the winner out of all this, though, will be Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson, because they will say, look, we've changed. We think that business should have a play a responsible role, and actually they'll win, because I think that if there is a substantial number of Labour rebels, they'll get it through the budget, because those Labour rebels will counteract those Tory rebels who might vote against the tax rise. So, you know, I wouldn't bet against Boris and Rishi actually ploughing on with this.
Yeah, Sonia, is this kind of another COVID budget, and we shouldn't expect anything too grand in terms of economic vision?
It's a good question. And, you know, ordinarily I'd say yes, but I think the fact that the budget briefing has started a week ahead of the budget, which is so, so unusual for anyone who's not kind of a close budget watcher. I remember the days of having been a civil servant and a special advisor where you used to beg Number 10 to give you 2 days on the grid because you just didn't have enough to brief and you wanted to keep good news in. So the fact that it's kind of a week out, and normally this space would be for people to push campaigns or whatever else, and lots of big measures haven't been sort of like repudiated. They haven't been challenged. The fact that stamp duty on the Times front page kind of was just allowed to run, whereas a traditional treasury would sort of hit back on that, suggests that actually maybe it's bigger than all of us are predicting or expecting. I think Rishi Sunak, well, the Chancellor normally does a Sunday round where he sets out kind of the broad vision. I think that will be really important to hear the language, not just on spending, which we've heard lots of, but also on kind of what's his economic vision going forward. So he's had quite a few statements like this where they're very sort of short term, but the space most people are in now is what is the long term vision? Who's going to, I mean, firstly, do you need to raise taxes? Are you happy with borrowing for a long time? Do you mind the fact that debt and the deficit are going up? Because that's like a fair question. And you might say yes, but that will change the sort of economic approach of the Conservative Party sort of forever. And I think one of his big challenges is, I think firstly, you're not going to get any big new taxes between now and April because the turnaround time is just too short and HMRC will never be able to implement them. So really, you're sort of looking at your autumn budget as like your tax budget, but that gap means you are leaving space for the people in your party who feel like they're not represented. They're sort of these fiscal conservatives who believe in low tax, free market and whatever else to sort of galvanise kind of a bit of a campaign and get some wind behind them. And I was just thinking the other day, you can see the development of like another ERG, but like an economic research group, you know, partnerships with the think tanks, making the case for the sort of competitive economy. So I think he's going to have a real challenge when he starts to come to make some of those harder decisions if he does defer them to November, possibly.
Yeah, interesting. And Rachel, I wanted to ask you about something Paul kind of mentioned there about why Labour is opposing even a corporation tax increase. I mean, Paul suggested that they want to, you know, win back voters in the Red Wall, but wouldn't Red Wall voters be quite up for a corporation tax increase?
I think it's, I spoke to one advisor this week, and I think Paul's talked there about some frustration among Labour MPs on this issue, but one of the advisors told me that Labour is focusing almost like exclusively on a group he called the LCBs, so who people at the last election who went from the Labour Party to the Conservative Party or the Brexit Party. And it's all focusing on those groups and why they left Labour. And yeah, just as Paul mentioned, all of the concerns that they would have had about the spending that Labour was prepared to do and how it was going to do that spending. You know, was it going to mean that they just wouldn't have their job because their job was being taxed out of existence, you know? So I think, yeah, they're focusing entirely on that group at the moment, yeah.
I think Rachel's right to mention spending because that, in the voters' eyes, tax and spending are almost inseparable. They're often really closely linked. So, you know, we know the academic argument that, yeah, OK, taxes can be raised and actually, you know, that's very different from us spending and investing or cutting. But actually voters, you know, they view it like their household budget and Labour still hasn't managed to switch that. And I think that's this is the whole admission. This idea of we've got to push low taxes, I think is an admission of defeat that they've lost their argument on their what they used to say under Ed Miliband and everyone else, which is, look, a household budget is very different from a national budget. Why don't you understand, voter? You know, ever since Margaret Thatcher, it's always been Labour on the back foot because she said, look, this is like my household budget. What comes in, what goes out, you've got to balance them. Now, in the real world, obviously, governments are not the same as households. You can borrow much more. You can have a bit more flexibility. But Labour's never won that argument. I think this proves that they're kind of conceding they've lost that argument. So they're doing this on the Tories' own terms. Either you tax or you spend or, you know, borrowing isn't really mentioned. And I think Labour thinks that if they're seen as whacking taxes on one thing, the voters think they'll whack the tax on them as well. So what I think what you might see in the budget is Labour, if they're shrewd, they've got to win back key voter groups, white van man and woman and self-employed. What's almost certainly going to happen, and Sonia might know more about this than us, is that, you know, Philip Hammond got into trouble for the idea of floating, you know, NI changes for the self-employed. I suspect Sunak's going to bring those in. In other words, I think you're going to see the Tory government who are actually going to whack some of the self-employed who've been hammered as it is in COVID, don't forget. And I suspect the people in the Treasury, they've long wanted to do this because the Treasury boffins say, look, on the one hand, you can't get all these new rights you're all clamouring for as self-employed, like in the gig economy, whether you're working for Uber or ever, getting paid holidays or rights. If you're getting all those rights, you've got a responsibility. The responsibility is you're getting away with murder and tax fronts. You've got to pay more taxes. Now, Labour, that's an opportunity for them. If the government does go down that route, Labour could say, we're on the side of the little guy. We don't want taxes on self-employed. In fact, the government has really let them down. And, you know, this excluded group is quite a powerful group of several million people. And Labour knows that, and Andy Burnham has been pushing that agenda, that that's a strong, rich political vein for them. So I think it's complicated, but I can see why Labour's doing it. I just think over the long term, it's going to be very difficult.
I think one of the ways that Labour will try to win this argument kind of was set out by Rachel Reeves a couple of weeks ago when she talked a lot about how much the government had been spending on outsourcing. You know, it's kind of a sweet spot for the Labour Party in that they get to talk about, say, Tory cronyism. But she also talked a lot about how much just the sheer amount of money being spent on that. And that would go, again, to their credibility that they were trying to, the credibility they're trying to build with how they would spend money.
Yeah, a lot of Tory MPs are annoyed about the treatment of self-employed and small businesses as well. So it will be really interesting if they get hammered, as you say there, Paul.
Thing is, Labour keeps talking about it, but what's it actually going to do? You know, they talked about the self-employed under Tom Watson and didn't do anything. You know, unless you get more people who've actually run a small business joining Labour and actually representing Labour, I suspect, you know, that agenda, people just think it's hot air.
Yeah, well, I know Sonia's got to go, so it's time for the quiz.
Yay!
Well, with much discussion of Carrie Simmons, this week's is all on Prime Minister's spouses.
Ooh.
Or not, in the case of the first question. Just shout the answer if you know it. Who is the last single person to be Prime Minister?
Ted Heath.
Yeah, well done, Paul.
He's married to his piano.
Question number two. Which prime ministerial spouse said in a TV interview, I get to decide when I take the bins out, not if I take them out.
Cherie Blair?
No, was it Philip Hammond? I mean,
Philip May. Yeah,
Philip May. Well done, Paul.
Was it during like a one show?
Cringe fest. Yeah.
It was when Theresa May talked about boys' jobs and girls' jobs.
Yeah.
God, yeah.
So bad. When you look back on that era, anyway, what is Carrie Simmons' new job?
I just said it earlier, Aspinall Foundation.
Yeah.
I don't know what a job exactly, job title is, though, but it involves stroking a lot of leopards, I think.
Does anyone want to have a stab at the job title for a point?
No, is it like, I don't know if she had a, could she just be a head of communication?
She is, yes. Well done. Well, Paul's won the quiz, but a point for Sonia. Keeps things decent. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for this week. Thank you to my guests for joining me, and make sure you subscribe to Common to People on all the usual channels, and please be sure to leave a review. And get your daily dose of what's happening in Westminster by subscribing to the Warzone newsletter at bit.ly/the-war-zone. We'll just leave you with Tory MP Jonathan Gullis being reprimanded by Deputy Speaker Eleanor Lang for his casual appearance on Video Link to the Commons.
No, I don't think we do go to Stoke-on-Trent. The Honourable Gentleman has to be dressed as if he were here in the chamber. So we will not go to Stoke-on-Trent. We will try to come back to Mr. Gullis in due course, but we will go now to Chesterfield, Toby Perkins.
Thank you very much, Madam Deputy Speaker. You'll see I've got all my clothes on, and I'm sure you'll be pleased to know it. But
hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.